When James made his escape from the Mexican soldiers, Annie's heart had been in her throat. She had been pleased to see him put a considerable distance between himself and the soldiers as they struggled to swim their horses across the river. It gave her a bright hope that he would make it to safety. Michael's grim expression dashed her exuberance. She knew he was remembering another time, other soldiers, and a race that had ended in the murder of their father.
I don't count him free till I know he's in Louisiana.
He's got a good lead on him, looks like to me.
Long ways to the Sabine, Andrew.
Michael turned toward his horse, then thought better of it and came back.
If they don't catch him, they're liable to come here hunting for somebody to take it out on. I reckon I'll stay a while.
I'm in no hurry to go home either.
It ain't none of your fight, Isaac. He's our brother, not yours.
There's times us Tennessee folk have got to stick together.
Annie felt her face warm again as Isaac's gaze momentarily touched her. She knew Isaac was not staying out of concern for Michael or Andrew.
Your brothers may be wondering where you are.
They'd be just as happy if I never came back.
Annie couldn't quite understand that, for she had known only the eternal closeness that existed among members of the Lewis family. True, she sometimes spoke sharply to James, but it was out of a wish to point him in better directions. It was out of love. Love must be a stranger in the Blackwood family, she thought, feeling sorry for Isaac. She sought out Petra with her gaze.
We'd best be fixing some supper, don't you think?
Michael took his plate and stood in the doorway, staring darkly toward the river. He ate but little. Annie had seen the turmoil in his eyes, the haunting by old and terrible memories.
Now I wish the world didn't have any soldiers.
Just before dark, Annie saw Michael tense, then take a few long strides out past the dog run. Fear constricted her throat, and she quickly followed after him. She knew Andrew, Petra, and Isaac were behind her, but she didn't look back. She stopped beside Michael and watched the soldiers coming across the river. She saw no sign of James.
Do you think?
By the set of their shoulders, I'd say they was mighty disappointed.
Then he did get away.
Annie thought the soldiers would probably come up to the cabin, perhaps seeking some sort of retribution. She knew by the worry on Michael's and Andrew's faces that they had the same idea. The soldiers might have lost their quarry, but the family was still here. They made no such move, however. They set about making camp on the river. Annie could see them starting a fire. Dark came, and they made no move toward the cabin.
They ain't coming.
What would you have done if they had come?
Whatever we had to. Marie'll be worried. I best get on home before she sends Mordecai over here hunting me.
Michael gave Isaac Blackwood a questioning glance.
They might decide to come up during the night. I think I'll stay. I can sleep here on the dog run.
Annie could see that Michael wasn't keen on that notion, nor was Andrew. But she felt grateful. Had Isaac not brought warning, James would not have escaped.
We can find you a couple of blankets, I'm sure.
I'd be much obliged to you, ma'am.
Morning came, but no soldiers. Annie walked out onto the dog run. The blankets were neatly folded, but she didn't see Isaac Blackwood. Unaccountably, she felt disappointed. He had probably sensed Andrew's disapproval. Andrew came up from the cow shed carrying a bucket of milk.
When did Isaac leave?
He was saddling his horse when I went out to milk.
Didn't you at least ask him to stay for breakfast?
He seemed bound on going. I didn't want to argue with him.
I suppose, no matter what he does, you'll never be able to forget that he's a Blackwood.
It's a hard thing to overlook. I look at him and I see Finnis and Luke. I also see old man Cyrus, who was never worth the rope it'd take to hang him with. Blood tells, Annie. Isaac shows a few good tendencies now and again, so maybe he's some kind of an outcross. But he's still got enough Blackwood blood to taint him. Was I you, I wouldn't waste any of my time feeling sorry for Isaac.
But I do, and I can't help it.
Let's go have some breakfast. I got lots of work to do today.
They were cleaning up the dishes afterward when Petra went to the doorway and looked outside.
The soldiers go.
Annie hurried to her side. She saw several soldiers riding downriver toward San Felipe. Her feeling of relief was dashed, however, when she discovered the two remained behind. She could see them and their staked horses still down there in camp.
They've left a guard to watch over us, I reckon, and to see if James comes back.
Will he?
It wouldn't be smart.
Annie would have to admit, if pressed, that not everything James had ever done was smart. But Michael and Andrew had made it clear to him that he had better go to Louisiana, and that he had better remain there. He had seemed to accept their advice. Andrew came up from the field at noontime, his brow furrowed.
Those soldiers look to me like they're fixing up to stay. They're building themselves a jacal out of some timbers and brush.
A jacal was a rude type of shack, a shelter of sorts from the weather.
They must figure to watch till James comes home.
Then I hope he's gone for a long, long time.
The cabin was short of meat, except for salt pork Andrew and Petra had put up themselves. Andrew badly needed to go out into the forest and find some game, but he was concerned about leaving the two women and the children alone while the soldiers were posted down on the river. But days passed, and the soldiers made no untoward move. He decided at last that they probably wouldn't, so he took rifle, powder, and ball and rode off west. Evidently, the soldiers had been watching. Not an hour after Andrew left, Annie saw them walking up toward the cabin.
Petra, we may be fixing to have trouble.
Andrew's rifle was gone from above the mantel, but Annie had her own in the room in which she slept. She loaded it quickly, for she had grown up in a family where the girls as well as the boys were taught a familiarity with firearms, along with the hoe, the axe, and the skinning knife.
You will shoot them?
Depends on what their intentions are.
Annie moved out past the dog run where she could see the soldiers clearly. Petra shut the children in the kitchen and moved out to stand beside Annie. She had no rifle, but she provided a moral backing by her presence. It took nerve, Annie thought, for she could see that Petra was genuinely frightened. Like Michael, Petra had a strong personal reason for dreading soldiers. Years ago, they had butchered her father for no better reason than a suspicion that he was not loyal to Spain. It quickly became clear to Annie that the soldiers were not coming to the cabin. They stopped at the pen where the pigs were kept.
They're fixing to try and steal a pig again.
Let them! We have more pigs!
But it's the principle of the thing. James' trouble started when he stopped them from stealing one of them pigs. Now they're setting out to do the same thing again to show us who the boss is.
A pig is just a pig.
Not these pigs. It's because of them that James had to run. Damned if I stand by and let a bunch of convict soldiers make it be all for nothing.
Annie strode briskly toward the pen, Petra hurrying after her.
You! Climb out of that pen and let those pigs alone!
One of the soldiers glanced at her and then resumed his pursuit of the panicked animal. He managed to grab the curly tail. The second soldier took hold of the thrashing beast and lifted it from the ground.
I'm not gonna say it again! Turn that pig loose!
The soldiers might not understand the words, but they understood the meaning well enough. Annie brought up the rifle and aimed the barrel through the fence.
You put that pig down or I'll shoot you!
The fun went out of it for the soldiers, and their laughter turned quickly to anger. They did not take her seriously. She was a woman. It was an affront to them that she would so much as threaten them with a rifle. From the corner of her eye, Annie saw a movement. She was almost afraid to take her gaze from the two soldiers, but she risked a quick glance. A horseman had just crossed the river and was coming this way. It was not the right direction for Andrew, nor the right color horse. She wondered if it might be another soldier. She already had more than enough. If she fired, she might stop one of these, but she would have no chance against the second. The soldiers became aware of the rider. By their sudden concern, Annie knew he was not one of their own. The soldier who held the squealing pig dropped it. It scurried off into a corner to join its fellows. The soldiers climbed out over the fence and trotted off toward their rough camp. The rider stopped his horse and watched them pass cautiously behind him, perhaps more intimidated by the rifle he carried than the one Annie had pointed at them. He brought the horse around and continued to watch them until they disappeared into their jacal. Then he came on toward the two women. Annie thought she recognized the horse and the way the man sat the saddle, but the face was different.
Is that Isaac Blackwood?
It is. He has no more whiskers.
Isaac had shaved away the heavy black beard, leaving his face clean, the lower part pale compared to the upper because the whiskers had so long sheltered it from the sun. Isaac reined up and touched fingers to the floppy brim of an old hat.
Morning, ladies. Y'all having trouble?
Annie felt so relieved that she could have kissed him.
I was afraid we were fixing to. You came along just in time.
Petra turned, unaccustomed to leaving her children alone in the cabin.
I must go. Thank you, Mr. Blackwood.
I don't know as I've done anything, except just ride up.
That was enough. You couldn't have timed it any better.
Ain't Andrew around?
We needed meat. We hadn't had any trouble with the soldiers, so we thought it was safe to ride out. And then I guess they decided it was safe to come in here and take a pig.
Isaac made a thin smile, staring at Annie's rifle.
Now, I don't know if it was or not. Would you really have fired that thing?
I was about to find out when you showed up.
You got a look in your eye. I wouldn't ever want you after me with that rifle. I do believe you'd use it.
I hope I never have to find out.
Annie studied his face then. She had never really seen Isaac's features before. They had always been half hidden by a growth of black beard. She would not call him handsome even now, but she could see strength in the set of his square jaw.
What went with your beard, Mr. Blackwood?
I decided to get rid of it. And I wish you'd get rid of that Mr. Blackwood. We're neighbors. Everybody just calls me Isaac.
Are you hungry, Isaac? It wouldn't take us long to fix up something.
Well, I'd be much obliged.
Isaac began walking beside her toward the cabin.
One thing I don't understand. It looks like it would have saved a lot of trouble if you just let them carry off a pig. One pig ain't worth much.
These pigs are. My brother James paid a high price for them.
I never looked at it that way.
Isaac held a brooding silence until they reached the dog run.
I'm afraid it's a lot bigger problem than just pigs. I hear there's been a right smart of trouble with the soldiers, one place and another. If the government don't do something before long, there's apt to be a killing somewhere. One killing leads to more killings. Ain't no telling where it'll stop.
You think this could eventually lead us into a war?
I just know that you ain't come to no happy country.
Texas, 1832. James Lewis decided at their first meeting that William Barrett Travis was a potential troublemaker, a firebrand who spoke his mind regardless of consequences. He liked him on sight. Travis stood 6 feet tall, weighed 175 pounds, and had a touch of red in his hair as well as in his temperament. About the same age as James, he was a lawyer rather than a farmer. He had left Alabama after a brief and unhappy marriage and sought new surroundings in which to make a fresh life. He came to Texas with a wagon train from New Orleans headed for Nacogdoches. James and Sly Shipman, with a pack train of mules, happened to cross the westbound wagons east of the Sabine River in Louisiana. A couple of the wagons were bogged to the hubs in mud. James and Shipman unpacked the mules and lent them to the task of dragging the wagons up onto firm ground. Invited to camp the night and share supper, they willingly accepted the offer to eat a meal prepared by someone else. Neither had more than passable skill as a cook. Sitting at the campfire, watching the reflected red light of the flames play across Travis's animated face, James found himself spellbound. Being a lawyer, the man had a gift with the language. Though he had not yet seen Texas, he had already learned much about it through diligent reading and inquiry. He talked of the land and its promise. He voiced a strong opinion that Texas should break its bonds with feudalistic Mexico and attach itself to the United States.
I do believe you're right, sir. I've felt along the same lines ever since I had a run-in with them convict soldiers. We wouldn't have put up with such as that back in Tennessee. We wouldn't have had to.
But Sly Shipman took a different view.
I don't reckon there's any law can stop a man from thinking what he wants to, so long as he keeps his thoughts in his head and don't let them all spill careless out of his mouth. But you go talking that way down in Texas, and you're liable to find yourself sitting in a dungeon cell where you can talk all you want to, and there won't be nobody to hear you.
You believe in Mexican rule over Americans, do you, sir?
I don't believe in anybody ruling over anybody. But that's the way the world is set up, at least in Texas and the rest of Mexico. Back where you come from, you could say what you wanted to so long as you could whip anybody who took offense and wanted to test your mettle. The law didn't mix in. But once you cross that river, you're in another country. They got a whole different way of looking at things. Say the wrong word and they'll figure you're trying to poke up another revolution. and they are sensitive about revolutions. They've had so many. Some army officer is liable to hang your ears up over his mantle.
I have crossed many rivers, sir, and I have found that however I felt on one side, I felt on the other. I do not believe the Sabine River will affect any change in my principles.
Maybe it won't, but I hope it'll make you careful who you're with when you speak your mind.
The next morning, James and Shipman watched the wagon train move on westward. Their own destination was Natchitoches, to the east, where they were to pick up goods from merchant Baptiste Villeray for another trading trip over into Texas. The trade was still clandestine, but many of the Mexican soldiers seemed to have wearied of trying to stop it, for it was like trying to halt the flow of the river with their hands. The two tradesmen could take their pack trains within shouting distance of Natchitoches and run little risk of challenge. They had a little more difficulty down on the Gulf Coast because a stricter officer controlled that part of Texas. The way James heard it, Mexico was beset by rebellions, one following another, to a point that the soldiers were never sure who their president was. Communications were slow and uncertain. To a degree, therefore, each commandant at an army garrison was a law unto himself. Some exerted this power like lions. Others turned their backs to trouble and pretended it didn't exist.
One thing Texas don't need any more of is lawyers. It needs farmers and carpenters. It needs more teachers and merchants. It's already got a plentiful sufficiency of lawyers to muddy up the waters for honest working folks like us.
Shipman and James were regarded by some as smugglers, but they looked upon themselves simply as merchants, ministering to needs that would not be met were they not there to meet them. James had never known much about lawyers. He'd been brought up too far out in the country to see them at work.
I guess they're not a bad thing to have sometimes. They're good at settling disagreements.
Who do you think stirs up most of the disagreements in the first place? Come on, we got work to do.
James looked back once before the wagons passed out of sight.
You don't reckon he'll have any trouble getting into Texas?
I doubt it, but I won't be surprised if he causes a lot of trouble after he gets there.
The Mexican government's prohibition against further immigration into Texas from the United States of the North remained officially on the books, but after a few months, it had begun to be honored mainly in the breach. Newcomers filtered across the border in ever-growing numbers, or arrived by ship at the mouth of the Brazos and other ports. They were hampered but little by a small military force that at first could not begin to catch them all, and after a time, didn't seriously try. Officials in Mexico's interior wrung their hands over the Americanization of Texas, but they could do little. Internal power struggles and recurring revolutions kept the central government hamstrung. It couldn't control the upheavals close at hand, much less do anything of consequence in distant Texas, a northern adjunct to the border state of Coahuila. One after another, presidents and statesmen deplored the fact that Texas had become more American than Mexican, but concern over their own individual survival took precedence over this affront to national honor. James paid little mind to the turmoil that kept festering to the surface deep in Mexico, except as it might affect the trading business he conducted in a loose partnership with Sly Shipman. He found many settlers in agreement with him that this instability was a potential hindrance to the peaceful settlement of Texas, and he wondered aloud sometimes if Travis might be correct in saying that Texas should attach itself to the United States and cut its ties to Mexico. He found many of the newcomers to be of that mind. The older settlers in the main were more inclined to bide their time and hope that conditions in Mexico would finally settle down. Mexico, they said, had been good to them in terms of generous grants of land. They had much to lose by angering Mexico into punitive action. That, he remembered, had been the sentiments of his brother Andrew. He had never heard Michael express much of an opinion on politics. Michael was a doer, not a talker. On matters of this kind, James pondered what Michael would do and did likewise. James had traveled over much of settled Texas in his trading enterprise, though he avoided San Felipe and the upper Colorado where his brothers and sister lived. Messages relayed to him by Michael and Annie through old Villeray warned him that the army officer who had sought his blood was still around, still appearing periodically at the Lewis cabins without warning, in hopes of catching James there on a visit. A letter from Annie had made the situation clear enough.
We would love to see you, but we fear the time is not right yet. Wait and have patience. Officers change stations. The land does not move away, nor do we. Someday, dear brother. Someday.
The months had passed and stretched into a year and more. His mind went back often to the Colorado River, though he could not, to the land into which he had been given no time to sink his roots. Someday. They were uneasy partners, James Lewis and Sly Shipman, quarrelsome with one another over small things, but usually together on matters of major import. Shipman, because of his much longer experience, expected to lay the plans and give the orders. James, a quick learner, soon decided he knew enough about the business to be a full partner in every respect. It became his habit to greet most of Shipman's suggestions with vocal skepticism, though usually, when he thought them through, he found them to be of merit. It was not that he distrusted Shipman's judgment. He simply didn't want to be subordinate. He had not taken well to orders back in Tennessee. As Travis had put it, James usually felt the same after crossing a river as he had felt on the other side, so he didn't take well to orders in Louisiana or Texas either. Though he and Shipman quarreled and sometimes seemed in danger of dividing the mules, they managed always to find a point of compromise and remain together.
The way I figure, if I was to go off and leave you to your own devices, you'd probably get yourself killed. That good-looking sister of yours would never speak to me again.
She wouldn't speak to you now.
They found themselves in the spring of 1832 carrying goods down the coast near Galveston Bay and into a seething cauldron of trouble. James had heard rumblings about it, but had taken only a passing interest in the reports, except as they concerned a stringent effort by the authorities to extract tariffs on all goods brought into the region. Working there, he and Shipman took special precautions to be seen only when they wanted to be. The situation confirmed James's feeling that Mexico had no business bossing Americans around. It was ironic that the first big confrontation came not from a Mexican, but from an arrogant and dictatorial transplanted American named John Bradburn, Kentucky-born and a veteran of many years in service of the Mexican government as a soldier of fortune. He had begun going by the name Juan Bradburn rather than John. For whatever reason, he was hostile to the American settlers moving into Mexican Texas, and he harassed them whenever his office gave him the opportunity. He was assigned to command the garrison at Anahuac, near Galveston Bay. That afforded him ample occasion to vent his contempt for his former countrymen. It happened that William Barrett Travis had set up a law practice not far from Anahuac in a new town called Liberty, made up largely of newcomers like himself. Even the name of the town hinted at resistance to the government. Many of its residents, including Travis, were illegal in the eyes of Mexico. Like the other latecomers who had no legal status because of the immigration proclamation, Travis was not entitled to acquire land or other property under Mexican law. He had to live in a rented room and subsist on what small bits of legal practice he was able to stir up. He was not hesitant in expressing his opinion about the law, about the convict soldiers who served under Bradburn, and about Bradburn himself, considered a turncoat by most of the American Texans for having committed himself wholeheartedly to the cause of Mexico. James and Shipman had no inkling that rebellion was bubbling toward a boil when they led their mule train down the coast, though they knew about Bradburn and were taking particular care to avoid his soldiers. They had been traveling mostly by night, laying up in the daylight until they neared their destination at Liberty. There they expected a lucrative trade. Sunrise had caught them still on the trail, looking for a suitable hiding place to spend the daylight hours. Suddenly they saw a considerable body of horsemen coming toward them. It was too late to hide.
Whip them up!
Shipman pointed toward a heavy forest a mile or so to the east. Once in the forest, they should have some chance to elude the horsemen, who looked at the distance like cavalrymen.
Yeah, yeah!
James set the mules into a hard run, but he saw the riders pull out of the trail and quarter across to intercept them. He popped the trailing mules with a whip.
Come on, boys, run for it, yeah!
He felt dismay as he realized the horsemen were going to overtake them before they could reach the wood. Shipman, riding in the lead, could see it too. He gave James a sign to slow down.
We can fight them!
James realized Shipman couldn't hear him. It would have made no difference if he had. Shipman was too cautious a man to fight odds that appeared to be 7 or 8 to 1. Reluctantly, James slowed, and so did the mules, once he stopped pressing. He remembered the smell of that cell in Nacogdoches and wondered what kind of jail they had in Anahuac. His despair and anger gave way to relief as he realized the approaching riders were not soldiers. They were civilians, settlers by the look of them. They were all armed. For a fleeting moment, he considered the possibility that they might be robbers, but that was unlikely. There had been little of that kind of deviltry down in the interior of Texas, though it still went on in the no man's land strip between Nacogdoches and the Sabine River, and occasionally spilled over onto a little of Texas along that border. Shipman raised one hand as the first of the riders reached him, showing that he intended no fight. James circled the mules to be certain they wouldn't keep running and perhaps be lost. That done, he reined Walker to Shipman's side. Shipman had quickly established that the riders meant no harm. The leader was a broad-shouldered man, fierce of eye and straight in the saddle. He had all the bearing of a man in charge.
We didn't mean to give fright. We thought you might be a couple of Bradburn soldiers bringing supplies.
No, sir. We are but honest tradesmen going about our business.
Honest? Smugglers, you mean?
James had long since decided that Shipman could sell overcoats in hell. Shipman put on his best salesman's manner in the same way he might put on his gloves.
Only because of unjust officials who would rob the poor to enrich themselves. Our only interest is to give the honest settler an honest deal. We ask no profit for ourselves except what little we need to feed our animals and keep hunger from our camp.
We have no quarrel with these men. They serve a useful purpose and earn whatever reward may fall into their hands.
The leader studied Shipman and James for a moment.
You've come from the north?
James didn't intend to let Shipman do all the talking.
We come from Nacogdoches, then along the Sabine as far as Acari.
You seen any Mexican soldiers the last day or so?
No, sir, but then we wasn't looking for any. We try not to get in their way and hope they stay out of ours.
We were afraid they might be sending reinforcements from the north, Nacogdoches perhaps. Is it possible you gentlemen have not heard about the trouble?
No, sir. In our line of business, we make it a point not to see more people than we have to. We don't hear a lot. What's happened?
You heard of Juan Bradburn?
Yes, sir. He's another we try not to see or be seen by.
He's presumed himself to be all-powerful. He declared the land grants around Liberty to be void, and he ordered the town itself abolished. When the citizens protested, he arrested Patrick Jack and a lawyer named Travis.
Travis? The one from Alabama?
All the same.
Shipman gave James a glance.
I told you. I knew he'd open his mouth too wide and fall into it himself.
No man should be arrested for saying what he believes. Free speech has always been an inalienable right for all Americans.
Not when they're in Mexico. And this is part of Mexico.
Bradburn declared martial law over 10 leagues of land. He intends to send Jack and Travis down into Mexico for trial. They'll never come back. Mexicans will shoot them.
That's too bad. Except for talking too free, he seemed like a decent fella. Especially for a lawyer.
We do not intend to let it happen. Men are gathering from all over this part of Texas, even from as far as San Felipe. They've commandeered a schooner and loaded cannon on it to attack Anahuac from Galveston Bay.
So you're going to Anahuac?
Yeah. We attack from the land side as the schooner attacks from the water. First we ride to Velasco to attack the garrison there. Its guns are trained on the Gulf. The schooner can't pass to Anahuac until the Velasco garrison is taken.
You folks really thought through what you're doing? If you fire on Velasco and Anahuac, you've declared war on Mexico.
Freedom-loving men have never shrunk from war, if that is what is demanded to preserve their freedom. The soldiers are mostly convicts, no great stake in whether Texas rebels against Mexico or not. We believe they will lay down their arms when they see the seriousness of our intentions.
And if they don't?
We will do what we must. The Lord loves freedom, and He will be at our side.
You've asked Him about that?
Prayer has its place in all our counsel.
I hope so, because you're going to need a lot of it if you get Mexico mad enough to send some real soldiers up here.
The horseman clearly had already passed judgment on Shipman, and it was not favorable.
We'd invite you two to join us in this mission, but I can see that you have no such inclination.
We're merchants, not lawyers and not soldiers. I don't see where we've got any reason to bog ourselves down in something that don't concern us.
It concerns me. I say we go give them soldiers a whipping. They've got it coming.
These won't be the same ones who ran you off of your land.
They belong to the same outfit. Fight one, you fight them all.
Damn it, we've got a business to take care of. We got goods here that we're responsible for. We can't be riding off and leaving them to take up somebody else's fight. We'd be letting down Baptiste. Travis talked his way into jail. He's a lawyer. Let him talk his way out of it.
We're wasting time. Whoever would go with us should come along. Whoever chooses not to do so may remain behind. We're better off without him.
James counted 14 men following the leader. He went to one of the pack mules and loosened the pack, opening a sack that contained their traveling rations of coffee, flour, and bacon. He transferred a little of it to a leather pouch on his own saddle.
It's a fool's errand.
I like Travis. It ain't right them putting him in jail for saying what he thinks.
That's a real battle they're fixing to have. You ever been in a battle before? An honest-to-God fight with gunpowder going off around you and bullets whistling around your head like hornets?
My brothers have been. My old daddy was. I figure if my brother Michael was here, he'd go.
I wish he was here so you could ask him. He might tell you to stay behind and mind your own business.
Not Michael. He's a fighter.
For a moment, James wondered if he was going to have to fist fight Shipman. They'd come close to it more than once, but had always managed to back away from the edge just in time. One of these days, he was going to have to find a more congenial working partner, or maybe just do for himself. He didn't really need a partner anyway. Shipman got down from his horse, looking as if he contemplated trying to stop James.
I hate to see you get killed before you even have a chance to grow up.
I'm 21. That's grown.
Your body maybe, but your head is still about 16. I owe it to your family to knock some sense into it.
I'm ready anytime you figure you're big enough.
James nodded his fists in preparation. Shipman took a couple of steps toward him, then stopped, shrugging.
Go ahead. If you're bound and determined, I've done right well for myself before you ever come along to aggravate my life. I'd probably be better off if they was to blow a hole through you and get you out of my misery.
James remembered the way Shipman had run off the time Sergeant Diaz's troops were closing in. In effect, he was running now.
You never did have stomach for a fight.
I've had my share. Maybe it's just as well you go ahead and get this out of your system. If you live through it, you might even come out a little smarter, which I doubt.
Wish me luck?
I wish you some sense. I hope you come back with more than you're showing now, if you come back.
I'll be back. Don't you be running away with our mules.
In later times, it would be said that the first shots fired at Velasco the night of June 25, 1832, were the opening salvo of the Texas Revolution against Mexico, though the full-blown revolution was yet more than 3 years away. There'd been individual confrontations before between settlers and soldiers, but Velasco, where the Brazos River emptied its muddy brown waters into the blue brine of the Gulf, below Galveston Island, was the site of the first pitched battle. The Mexican fortress was built of logs and sand in a circular configuration, its cannon atop an earthen embankment in the center, trained toward the Gulf, but capable of swinging in any direction. Around the outside of the wall, a deep ditch was intended to slow or stop any attack from land, though it had always been anticipated that any serious confrontation would come from warships in the Gulf. The Texan forces were under the divided command of John Austin, no relation to Stephen F., and Henry Brown. Shortly after James and the others arrived to reinforce the considerable number of fighting men already gathered beyond range of the fortress and shouting for a fight, a committee of invitation was sent to the commander of the fort, Colonel de Ugartechea, suggesting that he surrender the garrison. It His curiosity much aroused, James took it upon himself to go along with this group under a white flag of truce. Though he didn't understand Ugartechea's words until a translation was made, the colonel's grim visage told him the suggestion was refused. The interpreter spoke for him.
The colonel conveys his regrets, but he says his orders are specific. Part of his duty is the protection of Anahuac. To give up this post without a fight would be to desert Anahuac and compromise his dignity as an officer.
One of the Texan leaders bristled, ready for a fight.
If it's his dignity he's worried about, he could put up a show of a fight, then surrender. Down in Mexico City, they would never know.
The interpreter relayed the message. The colonel remained adamant.
He would know. He says the schooner shall not pass.
Tell him we respect him as an officer and a gentleman. Then let us withdraw and be about the business we came for.
James had never seen a cannon so large as the one on the center of the raised mound inside the small fort. Nor had he ever seen one fired. He shivered to an involuntary chill, though the June day was warm. For a moment he wondered if Shipman had been right. He had no business here. But he saw no such reservations in the men around him. They appeared a strong-minded, determined set of men spoiling for a scrap. The mood was contagious, and his moment of doubt passed. He was almost glad Ugartechea had not capitulated.
We're fixing to see a hot old time around here.
James was glad to get back to his rifle and feel the comfort of its wood and cold steel in his hands. It gave him a feeling of power, even invincibility.
Them Mexicans ain't much for fighting. One of us is good for five of them.
James hoped they fought better than that, or the contest wouldn't amount to much. The plan was announced while the men waited for darkness. The attackers would split into two groups and advance upon the fort under cover of night. They would take up and fortify positions, but would not attack until the schooner Brazoria appeared in the morning and brought its two new pieces of ordnance to bear upon the post. The Mexican garrison would then be caught between fire from the water and riflemen on the land. A group under the command of John Austin were to carry spades and wooden planks to the open side of the garrison and build a set of breastworks during the night. The second group, under Brown, was to circle the garrison and take positions behind a protective pile of logs and other driftwood cast up by past rises of the river. James was chosen to go with Austin's group. He could see the dark and ominous shape of the fortress in the night as they advanced. He wondered that the soldiers inside did not seem to see the Texans approach. It would have been far better to be able to move in the dark of the moon. James wished the sentries in the fort might be asleep, but that quickly proved to be a forlorn hope. He and the other Texans had just begun digging and setting up protective planks. Austin held up his hands.
Hold your fire, men!
But a man named Robinson, either misunderstanding or out of panic, raised his rifle. Robinson slumped to the ground, mortally wounded. Fire from the fort became so intense that some of the men began to run away.
Hold, man! Hold!
Bullets smashed through the planks that had been raised for protection. There had not been time enough to shovel up an earthen embankment adequate to reinforce them. The Texans returned fire for fire. James involuntarily ducked each time he heard a bullet snarl by, though he realized by that time it would have been too late had it been intended for him. The stench of gunpowder was so sharp that at times he could hardly breathe. He could hear screams from inside the fort and knew the Texans' fire was as deadly as that from the Mexicans. The only saving grace was that the big cannon could not be lowered enough to bear down upon the attackers. James found himself more than once looking back over his shoulder, wondering if he could make it to safety were he to jump up and run, as others had already done. Here, at least, the planks and the earth provided a modicum of cover. Better to stay in the little hole he had dug for himself than to take his chances out in the open. A Mexican bullet had grazed him. He felt with his right hand. The place burned as if he'd run against a hot poker, but it bled only a little. James had heard many stories about many battles, but somehow they all fell short of the reality he was experiencing here. The stories had always made the fight seem bloodless and without pain except to the enemy, but he felt pain now.
James Lewis! James Lewis, where the hell are you at?
I'm here! Watch your head!
He knew the voice. In a moment, Sly Shipman dropped down on his belly beside James.
You all right?
I'm all right. What are you doing here? I thought you said it was a damn fool idea coming to this place.
I ain't changed my mind about that. Just goes to show that there's two damn fools in our partnership.
Shipman touched James's wounded arm.
Looks to me like they've already proven it to you.
Lucky shot.
And a bunch of lucky shots from what I've seen. This outfit's pretty bad shot up.
So are those Mexicans. Every time one of them sticks his head up almost, he gets his brains blown away. Everybody said they wouldn't fight. Why the hell don't they give up?
Because they've got guts. Because they've got the same contempt for Americans as a lot of Americans have for them. They're fighting for their honor.
Damn little good honor will do you when you're dead.
That's a funny thing for you to say. You're the one always spoiling for a fight. Well, sir, you have found one. Enjoy it.
What do you do with our mules?
Left them with a farmer. Said he'd take care of them for us.
What if we both get killed?
Then I reckon he's got him a good set of mules.
Oh! The bullet whined past Shipman's head, taking off a little of his hat brim.
Move over, James, and give me some room. The people who weren't going to put up a fight, they're doing a right smart of a job.
James knew the cover wasn't enough to guarantee safety, but it was the best he had. He inched to one side, giving Shipman a share of the hole he had gouged into the sand.
I still don't see what you came here for. You were dead set against me coming.
I tried to go on without you, but them mules wouldn't let me. They look on you as kinfolk. You do have a lot in common. They kept telling me I'd better come see about you, that you'd probably fool around and let the Mexicans kill you if I didn't lend you a hand.
I don't see you doing any shooting.
I ain't mad at anybody, except maybe you.
James felt a warm glow inside. Shipman would not admit it in 100 years, but he had come to rescue James if he could, and protect him if he couldn't.
Thanks, Sly.
Thanks for nothing. When we get out of here, I'm going to whip you within an inch of your life.
You and how many others?
Sons of Texas is a Graphic Audio production. Copyright 1990, Tom Early, a pseudonym of Elmer Kelton. Published by arrangement with Elmer Kelton, care of Sobel Weber Associates, Incorporated, all rights reserved. Production copyright 2011, The Cutting Corporation, all rights reserved. Performed by Terrence Aselford, Tony Nam, Eric Messner, Drew Copus, Daniel Stevens, Thomas Keegan, Michael John Casey, Joseph Thornhill, Casey Platt, Christopher Sheeran, Michael Glenn, Joe Brack, Yasmin Toison, David Coyne, Dylan Lynch, Ken Jackson, Tim Carlin, Bobby Aselford, Ren Casey, M.B. Van Dorn, Richard Rowan, Nanette Savard, Nick DePinto, Patrick Stratton, Barbara Pinellini, and Elizabeth Jernigan. Additional red shirts by The Dead Giveaways. Book adapted for graphic audio by Johann Detweiler. Directed by Terrence Aselford. Produced by Rick Rowan and Dwayne Beeman. Executive producers James Cutting, Mary Cutting, and Angie Cornett. Dialogue editing and graphic audio sound design by Dwayne Beeman. With original music by Johann Detweiler. If you enjoyed Sons of Texas, be sure to look for Elmer Kelton's Huey Calloway and Texas Rangers series. Available at Roadstops Everywhere at 1-800-670-5220 or at www.graphicaudio.net, where you'll find samples of all our Action Pump titles, as well as free downloadable extras, audio guides, and podcasts. Keep listening for previews of other thrilling titles in graphic audio.
What's up?
I've got a case. I need you, Danny.
She pushed the file toward me. There were homicide Lay's photos. Gods above, when was this?
4 months ago. Look past the body.
My eyes moved over the picture. A pile of something wrinkled laid off to one side. Is that what I think? Oh, don't tell me it is.
The fucker flayed her.
Remember! 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 No!
I don't want to remember Rigger Hall. I have done very well for years without remembering.
Welcome to the House of Pain.
Have a nice night.
It is extremely unlikely.
Rigor Hall. I swore I'd never go back.
Dante Valentine, Book 2, Dead Man Rising, Part 1, is available now in graphic audio.
Remember Rigor Hall.
Graphic Audio presents E.E. Knight's Vampire Earth.
Gate codes! Is that what you want? There's a spare back door key!
I don't want access to Weathercut. I wanted you out of it, Franklin.
But I'm nobody important. I don't even have my own room.
That's the problem with being a nobody important. Somebody might decide you're disposable. Kind of like that teenage girl back in Arkansas. The one you, Bernardo Gutierrez, Tom Cray, and Sergeant Heath Hopkins raped and then killed.
No! I mean, you got the wrong guy!
No! 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 No!
What kind of op is this?
We're clearing this housing complex. D-O-E-R.
Of what?
Destruction of enemy resources. You can't stand to actually see a doer?
Enemy resources? You mean the population?
Without a population to feed on, the Kurians pull out.
No objections, I hope.
Objections? Hell yes! For starters...
Hop off your high horse, Valentine. Clearing operations work. Your old man invented him, after all.
He's hot. Sir, is he entering up as a bear?
No. I simply opened the channels. He shouldn't have the biological resource. Wait. Design, help us. I forgot. Oh, me. Your father was a bear, I believe.
I think so.
You may have had the talent passed down to you.
We better isolate.
Oh, and he needs calm now more than anything. Oh, me. I've been a fool, careless. I expect he'll go mad.
You, at the other end. Talk, or I make your puppet into a corn dog. Stop it.
What do you want?
Are you Seattle? The head honcho?
No, I am but a keeper.
I want to talk to your chief. King, grand and exalted overlord, whatever he calls himself. The one in the big tower. Tell him I have an offer.
What could a human give such as he?
Adler, the leader of the resistance.
Vampire Earth, Book 6, Valentine's Resolve. Available now in graphic audio.
If you can't find that graphic audio title you're looking for, go to www.graphicaudio.net, where you can order it in CD format or digital download. If you're on the road, call 1-800-670-5220. That's 1-800-670-5220. Or www.graphicaudio.net. And if you're looking for a great way to try out a different graphic audio series, check out our convenient and easy-to-store long-haul box sets, which contain up to 5 books of a series. Available only at www.graphicaudio.net. Be sure to sign up for our monthly newsletter or follow us on Twitter.